Please join me in welcoming Dr. Eric Mazur to share his thoughts on the concept of stopping time.
I pushed the button.
I believe that I was born. I have no direct memory of it, but my parents tell me it's true, and I have no reason not to believe them. I can vaguely remember being very young. I have this recollection of sitting in the back of our car. It was a brightly colored balloon. We were on a dirt road, and the ride was very, very bumpy. My parents tell me that I was 2.5 years old at the time. We were on a trip to Italy. Looking back, the flow of time appears to be very uneven. It is almost as if my internal clock and the calendar disagree. As I grew older, in particular, the rhythm of life has been a steady crescendo. The calendar tells me nothing has really changed in the rhythm of days, weeks, months, years. But I do remember very long days early on. In the beginning, days defined the rhythm of life. Seasons went by so slowly, years appeared so endless that their patterns remained hidden. Kindergarten and school started to define a new unit of time, the week. Then, as I went to high school, came the month, the season, the semester, the year. My memories become more and more clear as we approach this very instant in time. I remember watching the first man land on the moon in 1968, which for us in Europe was in the middle of the night. I remember leaving Europe for the US in 1982, clearing customs, arriving in a new world, and starting a new life. I remember my marriage, the birth of our children, the death of a relative. Most importantly, I remember the sequence of events. I know what happened first and what happened thereafter. I remember starting this talk a few minutes ago. I realize I'm talking now. And now that we've come to this instant in this little voyage from the past of my life, we notice something rather interesting. Ahead lies the future. And while I have memories of the past, I can imagine the future. And just as memories fail to paint a clear picture as we go further back in time, so does our imagination fail to paint a clear picture as we go further back, further forward in time. I can see myself finish this lecture in about, what, 3 hours or so? Just kidding. I'll put on my coat and go back to my hotel. I can see myself pack my suitcase tomorrow morning and board the plane back to Boston. I can create this future in my mind by putting together memories of real events. I know what my suitcase looks like. I know what the plane of Air Canada that I will take looks like. Am I trying to suggest here that there is no difference between recalling the past and imagining the future, between a historian and a fortune teller? I know I can't play this game very far into the future, but what is maybe a more convincing proof of the flow of time is that no matter how hard I try, my great-great-grandchild, for instance, remains a faceless, nameless child, even though I can look at a picture to see what my great-great-great-great-grandfather, that's him there, looked like. On the other hand, I will certainly never know what my great-great-grandchild will look like. Well, that great-great-grandchild will be able to see my picture, hear a recording of my voice, watch a video of me speaking or doing anything else. What then is it that connects the past via the present to the future? And why is there only a road to the future and not one back? Wouldn't it be nice to at least have some rest stops here and there? Is it our consciousness and imagination that are responsible for thinking of life as an unstoppable sequence of events? I know of a couple of instances where I could gladly have made use of H.G. Wells' time machine. This is an illustration from his book, where he is basically speaking to his younger self. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to travel back in time and correct some mistakes you've made? Unfortunately, we do not appear to be able to change the flow of history, because doing so would actually upset one of our most valued beliefs, namely logic and causality. We cannot change the past. Now, the present is a consequence of the past. So what about the future then? Can we still change it, or are the events there in the future out there just waiting to happen? I wish I could give you an answer to that question, but if you're waiting for one, don't hold your breath. In physics, we avoid most of these questions. After all, we don't want to put our colleagues in the philosophy department out of a job. And even though time is one of the great enigmas of the universe, in physics, time is represented simply by an unassuming lower letter case T. This letter T is the subject of my lecture. Now, since coming to the US, I've been taught that no talk should be without an outline. Well, this talk has three parts, surprisingly all dealing with the concept of time. I will first say a few more words about the concept of time. What is it exactly? What do we mean by it? Then I'll talk briefly about historical attempts at stopping time, capturing events that last only a very short amount of time. I'll finish by discussing some recent progress in the area of my own work that has enabled us to explore a new frontier in time, that of the shortest observable physical processes. Let us then first return for a moment to the concept of time. Time has fascinated philosophers and physicists, inspired poets and painters. Notice that these are all professions that start with the letter P. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. In spite of the fact that the symbol T that I just showed is the most used one in physics, the subject is rarely dealt with directly. Introductory physics textbooks don't even define the term. Time is just that, time. In dictionaries, and maybe if you come home, you want to actually check that what I say here is true, but in dictionaries and encyclopedias, time gets more room than any other word, more space than space. But the definitions given are more confusing than illuminating. I know what time is. It's a very familiar concept in human experience. But if you ask me to actually explain time or even define it in words, my ideas of time lose shape, much like the molten watches in Salvador Dalí's Persistence of Memory. And the more deeply we actually explore the subject of time, the more difficult it becomes to even define our words. And maybe this is because the very organization of our thoughts and actions depend on the concept of time. Can we perhaps establish a few facts? Well, many religions and ancient civilizations consider time cyclical, like the cyclical recurrence of days and seasons. In fact, the Greek had a god called Kronos, was a chi, as well as a probably older god of agriculture. Kronos was a kappa. And because of the strong ties between agriculture and time or seasons, the god for time by the Greek is often represented with a scythe in his hand. The great Greek philosopher Aristotle did not consider time to be a real entity. According to him, time was just a measure for motion. Aristotle times is very much like the frame counter on a movie or a video, with each frame representing an instant in time which can be counted. And I think that is the view that most of us hold intuitively. And unfortunately, There are no rewind or erase buttons in real life. The modern view of time is that it is unidirectional and continuous. As mentioned, time flows inexorably from the past to the future. There is no return. Imagine time would run backwards. We could walk backwards to a lake and see ripples on the surface of the lake spontaneously contract to a single point and then eject a stone or other object, which we would miraculously always catch. Life also would start somewhere in Mother Earth. At the beginning of our life, our fragile bodies would be taken out of a box dug up from the ground or assembled from ashes using fire. For many, life would start with all kinds of ailments, but with a mind that has surprising foresight. On the other hand, we would all suffer from an amazing lack of memory. Some 40 years before the end of our life, our gray hair would turn into some tint. At some point, the women among us would take their children into their womb, the ultimate fate for all of us. As we approach the end of our life, we lose the capacity to think clearly, to speak. Finally, as our bodies rapidly lose weight, we are forced to wear diapers. The last 9 months of disintegration would take place inside the wombs of our mothers, where ultimately just a single remaining cell would separate into its two genetic constituent parts. What I've described here is all so contrary to our experience that we must assume that time is unidirectional. Now, interestingly, most laws of physics do not have this unidirectionality built in. Were it not for the second law of thermodynamics, time could just as well flow backwards. This is in part because most physics avoids the entire question of absolute time and deals nearly exclusively with time intervals, the time elapsing between one event and another. Now, as we all know, time is strongly related to human experience. And it has been established that living organisms possess an internal clock, which is very strongly correlated with the cyclic clock of the rotation of the Earth. Now, the rhythm of biological clocks vary greatly. I once saw a program from the Nature series on PBS in the US that brought this point across very forcefully. Part of this video shows sea urchins and starfish. And at ordinary speed, as you see here, it appears that these creatures are motionless. One could almost believe that they're plants, not animals. Yet if you change the clock rate by compressing hours into seconds, you see that these creatures come to life. Small sea urchins attack and devour larger ones, leaving just the carcass behind. And all of a sudden, they seem to walk around like an army of little soldiers. Shown at high speed, also, starfish seem surprisingly active and social, frequently touching each other as if they're cuddling one another. And notice the enormous activity here. But as the clock is turned back to its normal rate, this life that you just saw here, here they are cuddling and touching, as you see. But as we change this clock back to its ordinary speed, this life of urchins and starfish suddenly comes to a grinding halt. That's going to happen in just a second on the screen in front of you. Now, this anecdote, here it is, we're back to the normal clock rate. This anecdote emphasizes two points. The first is that we are normally unaware of things that happen at timescales that are very different from our own clock speed. And the second point is a corollary to my first point, namely that we can open a new world by changing the speed of the clock. To see things that happen slowly, we need to slow down the speed of observation. To see things that happen very fast, we need to speed up the clock of observation. So let us now explore the options that we have to change the clock of observation. And a major breakthrough came with the invention of photography sometime during the 19th century. The first person to to make an observation way beyond the range of human reaction was the Austrian physicist Ernst Mach in the second half of the 19th century. The picture you see reproduced on the screen comes from a book of his popular lecture published in 1898. And it shows the motion of a bullet frozen in time. Notice how clearly, so this is the bullet here, notice how clearly you can see the shock waves in the air here in front frozen in time. These shock waves are very much, they're caused by the supersonic motion of the bullet through the air, and they're very much like the waves that form around the bow of a ship. On the original, it's sort of hard to see on this reproduction here, you can even see a wake of turbulent air trailing the bullet, like you see a wake of turbulent water trailing a ship. We normally don't see neither the bullet nor its wake because they both move way too fast for human vision. Mach's picture were the first to show that such a wake existed for objects that moved faster than the speed of sound in air. He obtained this picture by cleverly illuminating the bullet with a spark of a very short duration, an electrical spark basically, and synchronizing this spark to the firing of a rifle. I can't resist to quote a passage from Mach's lecture on the subject. "You may be disposed to say now, gentlemen," apparently there were no ladies at the time, "it is all very pretty and interesting to observe a projectile in its flight, but of what practical use is it?" "It is true," I reply, "one cannot wage war with photographed projectiles. And I have likewise often had to say to medical students attending my lectures on physics, when they inquired for the practical value of some physical observation, you cannot cure diseases with it." And he goes on and on like this. I read some 100 pages from his book without finding an answer to the question of the practical use. I think Mach actually seriously underestimated his own achievement, which ultimately led to mastering supersonic flight. As far as I know, Mach applied his technique only to supersonic bullets. The sparks were weak, unlike a modern camera flash, and therefore his apparatus was not suitable for other studies. Only a little later, Edward Muybridge, which was a photographer working for the US government, for the Geological Service, succeeded in capturing the most amazing series of pictures. While stationed in San Francisco in 1872, Muybridge heard about an ongoing controversy with regards to the locomotion of horses. And a particular question was whether a trotting horse, actually a galloping horse, pardon me, had all four legs off the ground at any point in time during each stride. Well, I don't know if you've ever looked at a trotting or galloping horse, but these feet move around way too fast for you to actually determine that. He was intrigued by this question and set out to actually photograph the motion of a galloping horse on the racetrack in Sacramento. And after a few test runs, he first tried to just take pictures at the right moment, but missed it. But then he had a brilliant idea, which I'm going to show you in just a second. Did a few test runs, and then he was in need of financial support because the U.S. Geological Service was not going to pay him to take pictures of horses. So he submitted his plans to Leland Stanford of Palo Alto, former governor of the state of California. He was hired by Leland Stanford and devoted many years documenting human and animal locomotion at Stanford Stock Farm, which is currently Stanford University. And his photographic plates, of which this is one, are still the basic authorities on locomotion. Despite the advent of video, high-speed photography, slow-motion picture, there's little that has been learned since Muybridge's monumental work. Actually, if you take these pictures, this was before the advent of movies, and if you digitize them and put them right on top of each other, and then, as you will see here in just a moment, play the frames in rapid succession, you get a surprisingly fluid movie. So in a sense, this is the absolute earliest movie that was ever taken back in the late 19th century. It's interesting to perhaps briefly explain how Muybridge took this remarkable series of pictures. So what he did is he went to a track that he made, and he had a, I have to go to the next slide here. Let's go here. And he just basically measured the length of a full stride of a horse, putting poles down at each step. So look at the right rear leg. And then with a stopwatch, he measured how long it took for a horse to complete a full stride. So now he knew exactly what the length of a stride was and how long it took. So the next thing that he did was place a battery of cameras, 12, I'm only showing four here, dividing the lengths of one full stride into 12 equal lengths. At first, he tried to put a person behind each camera and told the person to push the shutter button exactly as the horse was in front of the camera, but that never worked because human reaction time is simply not fast enough. So then he had a clever idea. He rigged all of the shutters of these different cameras up to a timing device. So it was a timing device that could sequentially fire the cameras. He would then stand behind the first camera, raise his hand to the horseback rider, and then press the button right as the horse was in front of the first camera. Then this timing device would run and fire the successive cameras at exactly the right time. And then he would have this precisely timed sequence of the stride of a galloping horse. And as you could see, I forgot to point that out, all 4 feet are, in fact, off the ground at a specific time. Some 40 years later, another milestone was achieved with the invention of the stroboscope by this man, Harold Edgerton, professor of electrical engineering at MIT and founder of an electronics company called EG&G. And he's shown here in a picture, I think, that typifies him. You may wonder what it is that he has in his hand there. First of all, he was the inventor, as I said, of the stroboscope, which is a device that is capable of emitting a flash of light, not unlike the flash we find nowadays on cameras, that lasts only 1/1,000,000th of a second. And using that device, he made many beautiful pictures, but let me first comment on this picture. What he's holding here is a balloon that has just been pierced. Oh, first of all, the reason that he's holding his finger in his ear is not because it was hurting or anything. No, because he's right next to the muzzle of a rifle that is firing shots. And as you can see, he's holding the remnants of a balloon, still maintaining parts of its shape, that has just been pierced by a bullet that has been stopped in flight there just before leaving the edge of this picture. His many pictures of bullets in mid-flight, like this one, earned him the reputation of the man who could stop bullets. Bullets piercing all kinds of things, but he also used it to freeze the motion of a golf swing or milk droplets splattering on a plate. This is actually pictures. The Harold Edgerton Center at MIT trains students in photography and science. And this is a picture from a recent project where you can see a droplet splattering on the surface of water captured with high-speed photography, things you can never see at ordinary speeds. Going back to Edgerton, some of the famous pictures he took were this one, where you see a playing card that has just been cut in two by a bullet, which you see here. And notice that even though the card has been shredded in two, the top part of this card has not yet had time to fall over an appreciable distance. It looks as if it's suspended in the air there. Of course, ultimately it falls down, but at the speed at which he captures, it has not fallen very far. This is affectionately known as MIT's recipe for applesauce, a bullet piercing an apple. But a series of pictures that I want to illuminate because it shows a technique that actually is still used today in research, including in my own lab at Harvard where we study optics, is this one. In the first picture, you see a bullet speeding towards a light bulb. and then it enters the light bulb. In the next shot, the bullet is inside the light bulb, and the light bulb is still maintaining its shape. And in the next shot, the bullet is emerging on the other side. And as you can see, even though the light bulb is broken, it still mostly has its shape because the little pieces of glass have not fallen yet over an appreciable distance. How did he do this? Well, it's a very clever, but very simple. That's the beauty of it, because I think most good science, even today, has a simplicity to it. If it's complicated, it's probably not good. And let me illustrate the trick that he used by reanimating the sequence. So the first thing to note is that one bullet, one light bulb, right? I mean, the bullet goes through, you have to put in a new light bulb for the next picture, and there is no way that you can take those four pictures, because bullet moves at several times the speed of sound, and therefore the time interval between these pictures is extremely small. There's no way that you can trigger a camera or even a battery of cameras fast enough to take the pictures at such small time interval. So that means that those four pictures that I showed to you a moment ago were not four pictures of the same light bulb. Those were four different light bulbs. They were just taken at different instants in time. Okay, so when he realized that, he thought, what can I use to trigger the camera? And as I said a moment ago, the bullet travels faster than the speed of sound. So if I animate the shock waves due to the firing, in addition to the bullet, that shock wave travels out more slowly than the bullet. And that was what he actually used to trigger the camera. Because what he did is he put this whole thing in a dark room, had a camera with a lens. This one shows no lens, but the real camera had a lens. And the shutter open, but because the room is dark, the film is not exposed. Then he added a strobe, which illuminated the light bulb at a given instant whenever it was triggered. So basically now the instant that is captured on film is determined by the firing of the flash. How do you trigger it? Well, you trigger it with a microphone that you place near the gun. So he would fire the gun, the sound wave would trigger the flash and then expose the camera. He would take the film out, go to the dark room, and in this case, as you can see, the bullet has not yet gone to the light bulb. So what do you need to do to capture the bullet inside the light bulb? My question to you, you move the microphone. So he would just simply pull the microphone back a little bit so that the sound wave needs more time to travel to this microphone and trigger it later. Oh, now we're getting better, so let's move it a little bit more here. There we go. And literally, by trial and error, he would get to the right point. Oh, this is a little bit too far, so let's move it back. And ultimately, you got this beautiful picture of a bullet captured inside a light bulb. Now, what Mach, Muybridge, and Edgerton's achievement all had in common is that they stopped time. They all succeeded in freezing short events in time and keeping them for posterity, something that's not that unfamiliar to you and to me because we do it all the time. We use cameras to take pictures, particularly pictures of moments that we enjoy so that we can re-enjoy them later. Edgerton's strobe allows one to observe events on a time scale of 1/1,000,000th of a second. Now, 1/1,000,000th of a second is a very short time on a human timescale. If 1/1,000,000th of a second were stretched to a second, then a second would become 2 weeks. In other words, 2 weeks is about 1,000,000 seconds. But what is 1/1,000,000th of a second on the scale of time in nature? In order to get some feel for that, let's make a little voyage through the powers of 10 on the scale of time. And what I'm going to show you here is the units of time, and the basic unit of time is the second, which is roughly equivalent to a single heartbeat. Now, for us humans, a second is pretty short because our fastest reaction time is about a tenth of a second. A ray of light, however, traveling at the speed of light, covers the distance from the Earth to the Moon in a single second. So let us now multiply this basic unit of time, 1 second, or 10 to the zero, which is 1 second, by successive factors of time. So at the top of the screen, I will show how far light travels in that unit of time. So as I said, in one second, light travels to the Moon, which is the edge of the territory in the universe that has been explored by mankind. At the bottom, I'll show in words what that unit is. So one factor of 10 brings us to 10 seconds, about the time duration of the 100-meter dash. Another factor of 10 brings us to roughly a minute, and I'll have a picture representing something on that time scale. About 1,000 seconds is about 17 minutes, the amount of time roughly I've been speaking here to you. In that time, light would travel from here to the sun and back. It takes about 8 minutes or so for light to travel from the sun to us. So whenever you look at the sun, picture this. The light that you see was emitted 8 minutes ago. Not now, but 8 minutes ago. If something happened to the sun, it would take 8 minutes for you to notice that here on the Earth. Another factor of 10 brings light out to the planet Uranus and is about the length of an average baseball game. 10 to the 5 second is about a day. 100,000 seconds is 1 day. 1,000,000 seconds, as I said a moment ago, is 2 weeks, which define the phases of the Moon. 10 to the 7 seconds, or 10 million seconds, is about 1 semester. Now watch out, because it's going to go fast now with successive factors of 10, because 10 to the 8 now is 3 years, and by that time, light has reached our closest star neighbor, Proxima Centauri, the star that is closest to the sun. Another factor of 10 gives us the time of a human generation, about 30 years. And in the next factor of 10, we move from 30 years to 300 years, so we've left the realm of human experience. In fact, we have to go back in history. Another person which you see prominently displayed on the Perimeter website, I think they actually even use exactly the same engraving here, is Isaac Newton. Well, 300 years is about the time since Isaac Newton. Another factor of 10 brings us back to the ancient civilization, 10 to the 11 seconds. Another factor 10, or 1,000,000,000 seconds, light has traveled to the center of the galaxy. And 1,000,000,000 seconds is essentially the time since the most recent ice age. Another factor of 10 brings us not to the center of the galaxy, but to the nearest galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy. It's about 300,000 years, or 10 to the 13 seconds. Another factor of 10 shows us the earliest human. So if people in the Andromeda Galaxy were training their very fancy microscopes on planet Earth, on planet Earth, and they'd be observing us, they would not see at this instant in time you and me, but they would see the earliest humans roaming around the surface. Another factor of time, or 10, or 1,000,000,000,000 seconds, because that's what 10 to the 15 seconds is, brings us to the age of the dinosaurs. Another factor of 10 to the continental drift. Another factor of 10 to the age of the solar system. And another factor of 10, or about 1,000,000,000,000 seconds, to the edge of the universe. And that time interval, or about, 13 billion years, is also the age of the known universe. So here we've gone from the second, the basic unit of time, and zoomed out on time. And notice that as we took larger time, we had to zoom out in space too and look at bigger and bigger amounts of space. Here we are at the edge of the universe and the lifetime of the universe. What happens now if we start with the second And rather than multiplying with factors of 10, we divide by factors of 10. Let's start again with the basic unit of time, the second. So a tenth of a second is the human reaction time, or about the blink of an eye. Another factor of 10 is the time of a golf swing. Another factor of 10 is the wing beat of a fly. In that amount of time, light still travels a pretty long distance. It would be traveling about from here in Waterloo to San Francisco across the continent diagonally. Another factor of 10 is the duration of lightning. Another factor of 10 is the time it takes a bullet to pierce a pane of glass, another of the beautiful pictures from Edgerton, which I cannot resist to show. So this is a pane of glass seen on edge, and a bullet has just gone through here, some fragments of glass. Notice how beautifully you can see this wake left behind. Well, it takes the bullet about 10 to the minus 5, or 10 millionths of a second, to pierce this pane of glass. A millionth of a second is the duration of the flash that was emitted to take that picture. Another factor of time brings us to the time it takes to write a bit on a hard disk. So next time you write your computer, picture this. Each time that a bit is written to your hard disk, it takes about 1/10 millionth of a second. In that time scale, light travels across this lecture hall. So it takes about 1/10 millionth of a second for light to travel that distance. So notice that as we go to shorter and shorter time, the lengths covered by light get smaller and smaller too. Another factor of 10 brings us to the calculation of a supercomputer. Like, this is not no longer a current supercomputer, but it was one of the first chess champions, Deep Blue, and it had carried out a full calculation in 10 to the minus 8 seconds. A typical computer chip, which has a clock speed on the order of 2 or 3 gigahertz, one cycle of that clock is on the order of 10 to the minus 9, or 1 billionth of a second. The technical term for that unit of time is called the nanosecond. Nano means 1 billionth. In one nanosecond, or 1 billionth of a second, light travels about a foot. As far as I know, that's the only justification of the imperial system of measures. But it is handy, I have to admit, as somebody who works with light. But you know, I was educated in Europe, so I'm a fervent adherent to the metric system, as you are. Another factor of 10 brings us to the fastest electronic switch. Notice, by the way, that in the past 10 years, computer chips have not made great advances in increasing the clock speed. I think that the gigahertz barrier was broken sometimes in the late 90s, and we're still at a gigahertz, and it's very unlikely that we'll have much bigger, much faster clock rates. And in that nanosecond, light, even though the chip is tiny, light still travels a macroscopic distance, the length of a foot. So clearly, light is a lot faster than electrons, which are used to generate electronic signals. And in fact, the fastest ever electronic switch is on the order of 100 picosecond, or 1/10 of a nanosecond. Now we have to start looking at much smaller things, because in 10 to the minus 11 seconds, light travels through a window pane, not a bullet, but light. And what is a physical phenomenon that is representative of that time scale? Well, we live in an atmosphere of air, and if you look at the time between the collisions of the atoms around you, well, that is about 10 to the minus 11 seconds. Another factor of 10 is the time that it takes these nitrogen and oxygen and CO2 molecules to rotate in space. So the nitrogen and other molecules rotate around their axis once in about a millionth of a second. Another factor of 10 is the vibration of these molecules. And on that time scale, even light starts to come to a crawling halt, because on that time scale, light travels only the width of a human hair, or about 100 micrometers, 100 millionths of a meter. Another factor of 10 brings us to the time scale of electronic collisions, the time scale that the electron cloud around the ionic core of atoms reacts. And another factor of 10 brings us to what is perhaps the ultimate frontier of directly observable processes, namely the femtosecond. Femto means 10 to the minus 15, or 1 millionth of a billionth of a second. And on that time scale, light hardly moves at all. It only moves about 100 atomic layers, or a tiny fraction of the width of the of a hair. Now, until Mach and Muybridge and Edgerton, the blink of an eye was really the bottom of the scale. And while Muybridge improved the resolution to about 1/1000th of a second, Mach and Edgerton to about 1 millionth of a second, it is only in the past 30 to 40 years, basically since the invention of the laser, that phenomenal progress has been made towards higher and higher time resolution. It all, as I said, begun with the invention of the laser in the 60s, about 50 years ago, actually an event that we're celebrating in the Optical Society this year. One of the first lasers that was ever made, which was called the Ruby laser, had a pulse duration of 10 to the minus 8, or about 100 millionths of a second, an improvement of about a factor of 100 on the stroboscope of Edgerton. And since then, the rapid progress in laser design and development has made it possible to reduce the laser pulse duration by about a factor of 10 every 4 years, until people reached the femtosecond time scale about a little over 20 years ago. And since then, very little progress has been made. Yes, there are some lasers that are capable of making attosecond time pulses, but they're not indivisible, and they don't allow us to observe the same class of phenomena as visible lasers, where the shortest duration is still on the order of a few femtoseconds. A few femtoseconds. That means that since light is a wave phenomenon, there's only a few oscillations that can take place in that short amount of time. And at a few oscillations, the frequency of such a short light pulse is no longer well defined. If you take a laser pointer, which many of you have probably held in your hands, the light that is emitted by these lasers has a very narrow frequency, a very well-defined frequency. But when you chop up that light in such an extremely thin slice of time, the frequency is no longer well-defined. And in analogy to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, if the duration of a laser pulse gets to be very, very short, we end up with an uncertainty in the frequency of a pulse. And if you look at the type of pulses available in any femtosecond laboratory, such as mine, you see that they cover actually a very broad range of frequency. Now, a pulse of such short duration is actually like a pancake of light, or photons as they're called, that is traveling through space at the speed of light. And the thickness of that pancake is only 1/16th the diameter of a human hair. Now, what has happened by basically making such short pulses is they've been able to squeeze a lot of light into very little space. And before I elaborate on that, since I'm an experimentalist, I would love to actually show you my laboratory. I can't take you all right now there. In fact, I can hardly stop time. I'll have to stop myself pretty soon when my hour here runs out. But I want to give you an impression of what it is like to set foot in an optics laboratory where we generate short light pulses. It all looks very pretty, and it gives an opportunity to take very pretty pictures because of all the laser beams and mirrors and bright spots and so on. And basically, as I said, what you do by making a short pulse is you take a light pulse and you squeeze the light in time. It all actually begins in a crystal, which is shown here, between two mirrors, which is pumped by a laser. which emits lights, and we use mirrors to relay that light to other optical components and amplify it and control the duration of that light pulse using techniques that go beyond the scope of my talk here. But I just want to show you what it actually looks like if you were to visit my laboratory. Now, because you squeeze a lot of light into very little space, you end up achieving phenomenal intensities, right? I mean, as I showed with that little animation, as you make your pulse shorter, if you keep the energy in the light the same, you end up delivering a lot of energy into very little time. And in my lab, where we, you know, easily produce laser pulses of tens of femtoseconds, it's not uncommon to achieve peak powers of 100 billion watts. Granted, we achieve those powers for only a very, very short amount of time. But, you know, that's on the order of the power consumption of a large city like New York, Of course, we do that only for a short time, so we couldn't power New York City for very long. A few femtoseconds. But the thing is, this allows us to achieve peak powers that are actually not easily accessible by any other means. In fact, there are many power plants that are required to power a city like New York City. And if we then take this light and we focus it, we can achieve peak powers and energy densities that are comparable to the energy density inside a star, things that you cannot normally do in the laboratory. I mean, none of us wants to get anywhere close to a star, or produce electric fields that are stronger than the electric fields that bind the electrons to the inner core of atoms, which really means that it is now possible to use light to take matter apart. Normally, when we look at the interaction of light with matter, it is matter that determines what happens to the light. You see me because of the light sources in this room and interacting with my jacket, my skin, and so on. And it's my skin and my light jacket that determine what happens to the light. The light strikes it and it gets scattered or re-radiated towards you. Now, it's matter that dominates there and determines what happens to light. When you get to these very short, intense pulses, the roles are reversed. It is now matter that determines what happens, it is now light that determines what happens to matter. And the interaction between these short laser pulses and matter is very, very different from what we normally observe. If you were to take the light from one of these sources here, the light from the sun, and send it through a prism to disperse its spectral components, you would find different colors. That white light consists of a whole range of colors covering the entire visible range of the spectrum, from blue or violet to green and yellow and then orange and then red. If you then take any single component from that spectrum and pass it again through a prism, you don't get any more spreading of the light because you have only one component of the light and a prism tends to separate the different components. If, however, you take a train of femtosecond pulses, shown here, and you focus it into a little cuvette containing water, something really remarkable happens because completely white light emerges. So here we're coming in with a very narrow band of frequencies in the red, and out comes white light, the opposite of what I just told you. The reason is that the pulse is so intense that it changes the optical properties of the medium through which it travels. In a sense, the light is modulating its own frequency. This process is actually called self-phase modulation. Makes for a very pretty demo, as you can see. And if you then take this white light, here you see the buildup of that white light if you look at the side of this cuvette. So red light comes in and slowly it turns wider and wider. And if you send it through a prism, you can see that you not only have the incident red light, but you have lots of different components. So what can we do with these short laser pulses? Well, there are two things. One is they're short, which means that you can freeze or stop the shortest observable processes. For example, we can look at the burst of a molecule. We can look at reagents coming together and forming a new molecule, which gave rise to the Nobel Prize in chemistry for a field called femtochemistry a little over 10 years ago to Egyptian-born US chemist Ahmed Zewail. You can look at the ultimate dynamics of electronic and material processes. For example, all of our computing and IT infrastructure, all the electronics, is based on silicon, and silicon using electronic signals. But as I just said, the shortest time scale for electronics is on the order of a nanosecond, or about 10 to the minus 9, a billionth of a second. A femtosecond is a factor of a million faster. We can switch light on and off a million times as fast as we can switch electrons on and off. So why then don't we have optical computers yet? Well, for a very simple but very annoying reason, namely that it's very difficult to control the flow of light with light. You see, in order to do computing, you need to control the flow of electrons with other electrons. That's what basically happens inside a computer chip or in a transistor. One stream of electrons tells whether or not a stream of electrons can flow or not. But as you know from crossing two light sources, light happily travels through each other without interfering at all. So it's very hard to control light by light, although I'm happy to report to you that we're making significant advances in this respect, and that therefore the prospect of doing computing with light is one that probably is not too far off in the future. And it'll be a huge advance because, first of all, as I said, you can switch light on and off much more quickly. But as you may also know, light doesn't dissipate as much energy. It doesn't waste as much energy as electric current. So it will require less power, and therefore we'll have battery. We won't require the battery storage that we require for electronics. I want to end by showing a few other things that excite me, because so far I've only highlighted the fact that you can do things on a very short time scale. The other aspect of it is that if you take a certain amount of energy in light and you focus it down in time to the femtosecond time scale, and then you focus it in space using a lens, you can create some pretty phenomenal intensities. Oh, actually, before I do that, I'm ahead of myself here. How do we actually capture things using light on a short time scale? Because there are no cameras that can take pictures. There's no electronics that can allow you to capture anything. So if you generate a femtosecond laser pulse, and as is shown in this little animation, fire it at some material, and you want to look at what happens to this material, any camera, any electronic means is just way too slow to record what is happening. So the only option you have is to use the light itself. And you will see now the parallel to the trick used by Edgerton to stop the bullets, because we do essentially the same with light. What we do is we place another partially silvered mirror in front of the laser, and now we have two femtosecond laser pulses, one that goes to the sample and hits it and does something to the sample. We call that the pump, right? It excites it. And another pulse that we can use to probe what happens. Now, as you saw, I had not enough mirrors on the table here, so the pulse went off to nowhere. So let's place a few more mirrors on the table, and now we send this probe pulse to illuminate the sample at some time before or after that pump pulse hits the sample. So if we now put a camera there, we can actually picture what happens after that pulse strikes it, because when the light hits the detector, that freezes that amount of time. Okay, so that's a specific instant in time. How do we get information at another instant in time? You move the mirrors. You just like, instead of MyBridge moving his microphone, we move our mirrors. If we want to be a few femtoseconds later, how much do we have to move the mirror? By the width of about 1/16th of a human hair. So you need very accurately controlled mirrors. I'm going to exaggerate a little bit in this little animation. So you move the mirror, and now it takes that probe pulse a little longer to travel, and you capture what happens at a later instant. That's the whole trick, basically, to capture dynamics that occur on a timescale of a millionth of a billionth of a second. Now let's get back to this high intensity that I mentioned a little bit prematurely. As you know, and you've undoubtedly done this, if you take a magnifying glass and focus the rays of the sun, you heat up materials so tremendously that they can catch fire. Now imagine that we not only squeeze them in space, because that's what a lens does, right? A lens takes any light that strikes it and squeezes it onto a very small amount of area. Let's imagine that we also squeeze it in time, and we can reach intensities that, as I said, approach those of the inside of a star. And that means that the strangest things occur. For example, you can take a transparent material and take a femtosecond laser pulse and focus it inside the bulk of this transparent material. Now, what does the word transparent mean? Transparent means light goes through it, which means the material is not interacting with the light. Well, it turns out that if you focus the light so tightly, it actually rips the electrons off the atoms in the center of the glass and does actually manage to deposit its energy inside the glass. So what we do in our, this is a technique that we pioneered some 15 years ago, if you take a microscope objective and you take your femtosecond laser pulse and you focus it inside a piece of glass, you can actually create a spark inside that glass and create microscopic damage. So these are little bits that have been written inside a piece of glass, without actually physically entering the glass. It's just the light that enters the glass. And the size of these little defects that we create is on the order of about a few hundred nanometers, or about a thousandth the diameter of a human hair. And in fact, if you go now to a number of tourist places, they will sell you chunks of glass that have inscripted inside it three-dimensional representations of the tourist attraction at U.S. So if you go to New York, you can see the Statue of Liberty. If you go to Paris, it's a technique that was basically developed from what I just illustrate here. It can be used for data storage in three dimensions, and there are a number of other applications. If you hit the surface of materials with these short laser pulses, wild things happen. This was a serendipitous discovery that we made about 17 years ago in my lab. We took a laser pulse and focused it on the surface of a silicon wafer. Silicon normally looks like a mirror and is flat. And after it's been irradiated by these short laser pulses, you get this forest of spikes that turns silicon completely black. And it turns out that this black silicon that we had created accidentally has the most remarkable properties. The atoms have been rearranged, certain defects have been introduced in the material, and now we have a company, Psyonix, for black silicon, that is actually commercializing this material to make much more sensitive photodetectors and imagers based on this material. Things that would not have been possible a few years ago had we not had the capability of shortening our optical laser pulses. Here's another picture of the surface of a material hit by one of these femtosecond laser pulses. And lastly, I want to show you something we do on the interface between biology and physics. This is a picture, a microscope picture, of a little worm, which is about a millimeter long and about the width of a hair, called C. elegans. It's a ringworm that lives in the ground. It's very simple. It has about 1,000 cells, of which 301 are neurons. And each and every little worm has exactly the same wiring diagram. First of all, 300 neurons out of about 1,000 cells makes this little animal rather intelligent for its size. We have a lot more neurons, but our fraction of cells that are neurons are nowhere near 1/3. So this is a pretty highly intelligent animal. And if you look at them under the microscope, they react to temperature differences. If you tap their nose, they will reverse direction in which they're propagating. So they can sense pressure. They can sense temperature, they can sense chemical because they have to know what to eat and what not to eat. But because they have an invariant wiring diagram, each and every C. elegans has exactly the same wiring between neurons, much like cars running off an assembly line have exactly the same electrical harness in them, we can actually use the C. elegans to study the connection between the neural network and its behavior. We can come in with our femtosecond laser pulses and rupture one of these neurons. Here are two neurons that are actually responsible for temperature sensing. They have these two axons that go towards the front of the animal. And we can actually cut either the axon or the dendrite. Sorry, the dendrite is here. We can cut either the dendrite or the axon or a connection to another neuron and see how it affects the behavior to elucidate the connection between neural network and behavior. Why can we do that with these femtosecond pulses? Don't we just blow up this entire C. elegans if we focus a femtosecond laser pulse and its parts end up on the ceiling of our lab? Remember, what is special about these femtosecond laser pulses is that they have very high intensity. The energy, on the other hand, is very, very low. It's just that that energy has been focused into very little time and very little space. And because it has been focused in very little time and very little space, the intensity is high. But the total amount of energy is very, very low. In fact, the amount of energy that we deliver to a cell is on the order, or to a neuron, is on the order of one nanojoule, or a billionth of a joule. Next time that you eat a candy or a snack, look at the nutrition label, and you'll see that it has kilojoules on it, okay? So you eat a candy, and it's hundreds of kilojoules, which is 10 to the 9, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 14 orders of magnitude more than the energy that we deliver. So the intensity is high, which causes the disruption, but the energy is so low that once we've caused a disruption, nothing around it has been hurt. So it's like the most exquisite, precise scalpel you can imagine, such precision that we can operate at the intracellular level. So here's a picture of these two neurons, which we make fluoresce, and here you can see a cut that has been made, and you can see the detached end of the dendrite separated from the neuron. And then we can do behavioral tests to see what the effect is in order to better understand the neural network of the C. elegans. Here's another picture of a single cell. This is a single endothelial cell, a cell that lines the arteries. And the little spaghetti you see here are the mitochondria, the little subcellular elements that are responsible for the energy housekeeping in the cells. And aging is related to the decaying of these mitochondria inside cells. This dark region here is the nucleus. We can go in the cell and eliminate a single mitochondrion without either killing the cell or damaging neighboring mitochondria. And we use that technique in collaboration with people at the Harvard Medical School to determine whether or not the mitochondria form a network or are isolated subcellular elements. And I want to show you here the surgery in real time as we eliminate a single mitochondrion, this one here that has sort of a C shape. So here's the movie, which is more or less real time with a 2 nanojoule pulse. We focus it right here. And as you can see, you can't see the pulse because it's invisible, but you can see this mitochondrion break up into 4 different parts that then go away. So here's that mitochondrion. Now you can see it sort of purling up into different parts. And then if you look a little later, the whole mitochondrion is gone. And that type of exquisite precision, again facilitated by this short amount of time, makes it possible to better understand the intracellular mechanics. So before ending my talk, I would like to say that what we've seen in this short overview that I gave here is that advances in time resolution have all been related to advances in optics, right? We started with the blink of an eye, and then we went to photography, and then the flash lamp, and then ordinary lasers, and ultimately femtosecond lasers. Only time will really tell what the ultimate frontier is. But I'd like to come back to what I said a moment ago, how time is related to human experience. And there are many poets that have written about it. For example, this is one poet, Alphonse de Lamartine, who is writing about a couple who is spending a night together and desperately wants this night to last forever. But as you know, when you're having fun, things fly by like that. Whereas if you're not having fun, time, in absolute irony, goes incredibly slowly. And that's actually what he's trying to describe here. Oh, time, suspend your flight. And you, auspicious hours, suspend your course. Let us savor the fleeting joy of our most beautiful days. Plenty of unhappy ones down there beg you, fly by for them. Along with their days, take the worries that consume them. Forget the happy ones. In vain, I ask for a few more moments, but time escapes and flees. I say to this night, slow down, but dawn will dissipate the night. Well, a look at the clock tells me that the very subject of my lecture will soon be forcing me to stop. For if there's one frontier that I would not like to explore, it's that of your patience. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mazur. Okay, we will now open the floor to questions. We raise your hand and we will deliver a microphone to you. So do we have questions? I see a hand. I see Renee.
Good evening, Dr. Mazur. Can you please tell us briefly about the Planck time and why that has to be the shortest unit of time in physics?
Well, okay. Notice that I've stopped way before the Planck time, right? I've stopped at 10 to the minus 15 seconds. And there are plenty of other processes that occur on a much shorter time scale. Like, for example, if you go to high energy physics, you can, but indirectly, measure the lifetime of particles. And the lifetime of many particles is on the order of 10 to the minus 22, 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So that's orders of magnitude shorter than femtosecond. I have stayed within the realm of direct observation. I'm an experimentalist. I like to be able to observe things directly. So to me, the edge of the time scale is the femtosecond, because that's where our direct observation ends. And anything else comes from indirect observation, such as the lifetime of particles. And as we get to the Planck time, we get into pretty esoteric physics, which I think goes a little bit beyond the scope of this talk.
First, I'd like to thank you, I think, on behalf of everybody for it. Fascinating talk, and maybe it was a little too short.
Femto short.
Yeah. This is a little more of a potentially technical question. Your pictures of the silicon that you'd zapped looks an awful lot like pictures I've seen of the processes that people use to produce carbon nanotubes. Is there any connection at all?
There is some connection. What basically happens is that you heat the surface of the silicon so fast that a process called ablation happens, and the material basically expands and heats so fast that it gets ejected from the surface. And it gets ejected, what happens is first the surface melts and it forms an undulating pattern. And as it forms an undulating pattern, the light gets focused in the valleys. And therefore, the ablation preferentially takes place in these valleys rather than on the tops. When you started your question, I was first thinking that you were going to refer to something that somebody only recently pointed out to me. If anybody here has ever been to Chile, in particular to Patagonia, and you look at you walk on the glaciers there, there is a phenomenon called the Pinitentes, which is a structure from ice on the glaciers that looks exactly like that. It has these conical, these big cones of ice that are pointing in the direction of the sun. So because it's fairly south on the southern hemisphere, they're not normal to the Earth's surface, but they're at a slight angle. the spikes that we have here also follow the direction of the light. So if our laser pulse is not incident normally, but goes at a grazing angle, all these spikes turn towards the light. Again, why? Because you have ripples, and it's in these valleys that most of the light get deposited. The growing of carbon nanotubes is very differently, because that's done by generating material and depositing it on a sample. We're basically removing material from a surface using light. So yes, the surface structure may look somewhat the same. The scale is different. Carbon nanotubes are on the order of nanometers, whereas these surface structures are on the order of micrometers. So they're about a factor of 1,000 larger than carbon nanotubes.
I noticed you're taking some images of biological organisms or entities. How do you keep them still enough for focus on those things at such short time frames?
Very good question. How do I keep them still? I have very good students, but they can't fire. If you see these little worms, should I show a little video? I can show a little video. Okay, so here they are, and you see they crawl around. So, you know, I mean, femtosecond lasts a short amount of time. By the way, what you see here is the turning on of an ultraviolet light. And we have actually made these neurons express green fluorescent protein, which makes them light up. Because first of all, you have to find the neuron that you want to target. So we do that by inserting the gene sequence for the green fluorescent protein in the gene sequence for that neuron. So now you have a little worm and its offspring that conveniently show these neurons. But as you see, they move around. And my grad students are good, but they're not that good that they can fire the laser. So what we do is we actually have to anesthetize the worm. So we use an anesthetic, it remains still, and then still you have to target it. You basically, what you do is you place a piece of glass on the microscope and you crank the laser up really high, so high that it's going to generate a spark in the glass. So once it generates a spark, we can see on the monitor of the microscope where that spark is. We put a crosshair. Then we take the glass away. We reduce the intensity to whatever we need, nanojoules. We put the anesthetized worm in place, move the worm until that neuron that we want to target lines up under the crosshair, bring the neuron in focus, because then we know that our laser pulse is going to hit there, and then zap. And it's done. And then we rinse off the anesthetic, which literally takes only rinsing off, and revive the worm. And then do a behavioral test to see what has been accomplished. So that's basically how we do it.
I'd like to thank you again for the beautiful and exciting presentation. Again, in the line of these biologicals, would you please, or could you please comment on the possible implication on these nanosurgical procedures to target on, shall we say, cancer cells and eliminate them or shoot them? Or?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I've often asked myself. I'm not a biologist, so I have to rely on collaborators in biology and across the river in Boston at the Harvard Medical School for advice. Now, you and I and everybody else consist of about 150 trillion cells, right? So one cell is nothing, right? When you stroke your hair or rub your hand somewhere, you probably lose a few thousand cells without even noticing. So shooting one mitochondrion in one cell is not going to do anything to any human being or any living being larger than a C. elegans, which is a really tiny organism. However, you could think of manipulating one cell and then using the machinery of biology to replicate that change. So one of the things that we're doing now in collaboration with colleagues in biology is we are interfering with the cell division. During cell division, the chromosomes get pulled apart. And if somehow you can interfere with that pulling apart, you can interfere with the machinery of reproduction and then perhaps induce a change that can then replicate itself. That might be an avenue. But for now, I would say femtosecond pulses are mainly, at least in this arena that I have described, a research tool, a way to better understand the machinery of life. On the other hand, there are some practical applications. For example, for ophthalmic surgery, it turns out that femtosecond lasers are significantly better than lasers with a longer pulse duration. Why? Well, because they deliver less energy, more intensity, but less energy. So any collateral damage, as it's called, damage outside the area that you want to irradiate, is avoided. So for ophthalmic surgery, femtosecond lasers are very quickly becoming the norm. Likewise, femtosecond lasers might have applications for dentistry as a replacement for mechanical drills. Why? Because, again, you have high intensity, so you can remove material, but you have very little energy, so very little heating, which would end up being painful, right, if you heat, and which is also the source of pain with a mechanical drill. So in dentistry, you could see other applications coming pretty soon. But in terms of cancer treatment, I think that is still far off.
Let's thank Dr. Eric Mazur.